Does time-restricted eating result in weight loss?
Is testosterone replacement therapy safe for your heart?
How often are effective medications used for alcohol use disorder?
And how does aspirin affect the incidence of anemia in the elderly?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with the oldest one first, and that's this issue of aspirin and anemia in older adults. It's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
Since approximately 50% of older persons in the United States take aspirin for preventive uses, this is actually a pretty important topic. Concomitantly, anemia is pretty common as well in the elderly. Sometimes it's just because they have chronic diseases like kidney disease, an inflammatory condition. Sometimes they're iron deficient. And then about a third of time, we just don't know what causes it. We call it anemia of the elderly. And because aspirin has dual effects, antiplatelet agent, and it also is anti-inflammatory. So the question is, for older individuals taking aspirin, does it increase or decrease the incidence of anemia? The investigators did a post hoc analysis of a study. This was an aspirin in reducing events in the elderly. They took older individuals and put them on low dose aspirin, 100 milligrams, just to see whether over the long term they'd have a better life. They tested blood every year during the 5 years the study went on. But what they found is that older individuals that took aspirin had a 20% increased incidence of anemia. And you think, well, that's because they had a lot more major bleeding. Actually, that wasn't the case. But it's this kind of occult blood loss that probably occurs in these individuals. I think we're going to hear about using it less commonly in the elderly because of this and other potential complications associated with aspirin use.
What's your view on the alternative to that?
This is a balance between the risk and the harms. So for individuals that clearly have heart disease or cerebrovascular disease, it's beneficial. But let's take a 70-year-old individual that is at low risk for cardiovascular disease. Then you have this harm of anemia, major bleeding. So as this information comes in, I think we're better able to assess the harms versus the benefit in particular patient populations.
Clearly, we have talked many times, and it seems like more frequently, about really having to tailor over the life course the implementation of different therapies. And this sounds like it's yet one more.
It is, because Elizabeth, the incidence of anemia continues to grow the longer that you're on aspirin.
Staying in Annals of Internal Medicine, let's turn to this issue, and again, it's a recurring one, about time-restricted eating. In this population, they did without calorie counting for weight loss, and it's a racially diverse population. They enrolled 90 adults with obesity. There were 77 who completed this study. Their mean age was 40 years, 33% of whom were Black, 46% were Hispanic. And they said, we're going to compare time-restricted eating to calorie restriction to basically a control group. They followed these folks for a year. The time period during which those folks who were on the time-restricted eating, when they could actually consume calories, was between noon and 8 p.m. Their calorie reduction group was prescribed a 25% energy restriction from baseline, but were not asked to change that eating window. They basically saw that at 1 year, the weight losses were 3.5 and 4.3 kilograms in respectively the TRE, the time-restricted eating, and the calorie restriction groups. The control group gained 1.1 kilograms. So there was no real statistical significance in the differences between time-restricted eating and calorie restriction in secondary outcomes, looking at body composition, self-reported energy intake, steps per day, lipids, blood pressure, insulin, glucose, and hemoglobin A1C. They also provided in this study counseling. So that's another important factor to be considered here.
I guess people are motivated differently. To me, time-restricted eating is pretty easy. You just decide you're going to eat between noon and eight. You don't worry about the calories, and you're still able to lose weight. Now, you're able to drink non-caloric beverages. It's a pretty simple diet. Now, there are some people that just can't do that. And for them, doing a caloric restriction where they count calories, look at food, is better. Both of them are effective and much more effective than just nutritional counseling.
Clearly, some assessment of, well, who are you and what's your approach to things before attempting a diet is probably a good idea.
Absolutely.
Let's turn to this issue of testosterone and the heart.
This is the New England Journal of Medicine, Elizabeth. This is a very well done study of over 5,000 men aged 45 to 80 who had symptoms of low testosterone, decreased libido, decreased energy, decreased spontaneous erections, low depressed mood, hot flashes even. They were assigned, after documenting twice they had low testosterone, to either testosterone or placebo, with the intention of determining, did testosterone therapy increase the risk of cardiovascular events? These are men that had known cardiovascular disease or had multiple risk factors. And the reason they did this study was because back in 2015, the FDA issued guidance that required manufacturers of approved testosterone products to actually conduct these trials because there were some conflicting data that testosterone therapy could increase cardiovascular events. So they took high-risk men, put them on testosterone or placebo, and what they discovered was that the testosterone administered as a gel did not increase the risk of cardiovascular events. However, there were some side effects. It doubled the risk of pulmonary embolism from about 0.5 to 0.9%. It increased the risk of atrial fibrillation from about 2% to about 5%.
Talk to me about where you think this notion of low testosterone fits into when we talked about lifespan of men, and is it something that just declines anyway?
Testosterone does decline. There's no question about it. We know what the normal ranges are for age group specific, but there are men that even within that have lower testosterone. We know that testosterone in older men improves sexual function, increases bone mineral density. It can actually treat unexplained anemia.
So what would you say to a guy who says to you, look, I've got these symptoms and I'm going to try this gel with regard to these other risks?
I'd certainly screen them. But what I would say is that even in men that have known cardiovascular disease or at high risk of such, it can be safely taken with regard to their cardiovascular disease. And again, this is an individual decision. Now, the other thing I'd mention, Elizabeth, it's clear that it increases the risk of prostate cancer as well. In this short-term study, there wasn't noticed, but they specifically excluded men that had a previous history of prostate cancer.
More coming, I bet, about this one. Let's finally turn back to Annals of Internal Medicine and take a look at pharmacologic treatment initiation among Medicare beneficiaries who are hospitalized with alcohol use disorder. I have a lot of sensitivity to this because on the MICU, we see a lot of people who have acute liver problems as a result of alcohol use disorder. And it turns out that there are 29 million adults in the United States who have this, and it contributes to more than 140,000 deaths annually. It turns out that there are treatments for this, pharmacologic treatments that include naltrexone, a camprosate disulfiram, and they call this MAUD, medication for alcohol use disorder treatment. So this study took a look at, well, all right, if you're hospitalized and this is something that's on your chart, how often is this actually initiated, pharmacologic treatment? Their cohort included over 28,000 alcohol use disorder hospitalizations, representing over 20,000 unique patients. What they found was that MAUD treatment initiated within 2 days of discharge occurred 0.7%. of the folks had treatment initiated within 2 days. 1.3% initiated within 30 days. This is pretty pathetic as far as I'm concerned. They looked at, well, what's associated with initiation? Younger age and those who had access to psychiatry or addiction medicine.
You'd think that it would be treated with effective therapies. And by the way, these therapies do one of two things. Either they decrease the craving for alcohol by changing the neurotransmitters, or they actually cause aversive reactions when alcohol is ingested. And all three of the agents that you mentioned have been approved by the FDA. They've been around since, gosh, the mid-1990s. They've been shown to be effective. Their safety profile is pretty good. So to hear that less than 2% of individuals diagnosed with alcohol use disorder actually prescribe these medications is very disturbing. When you say these are individuals, they were hospitalized. Some of them were hospitalized for the alcohol use disorder. Some of them, they were just noted to have it. That was a secondary diagnosis. Nevertheless, these are all individuals that could benefit from pharmacologic therapy. So this was really a sobering finding.
And then some of the other factors that they were able to look at included regional variation and also significantly higher initiation among white people than among non-Hispanic Black people or Black people, which is just really troubling.
This is clearly a missed opportunity because these patients are hospitalized. They're a captive audience. And this is a unique opportunity to both make the diagnosis and to initiate therapy. We talked before about the paucity of inpatient addiction healthcare professionals. We need to pay attention to this and make these services and these medicines available.
I would say that the editorialist notes that medication-assisted treatment of alcohol use disorder increased in one of their studies from 0 to 64%, accompanied by a decrease in all-cause 30-day readmission rates and hospitalization, which is a great thing. The editorialist also suggests that hospitalists should become involved in the initiation of treatment. And I would just note that in my observations of hospitalists, in many respects, it's a lot like primary care docs in that there's just such a huge laundry list of things that they take care of. Adding this to this also just seems like it might be a big lift.
But how they did that in the study you mentioned was it was a part of the discharge protocol. When you discharge somebody, there are certain orders you write. And one of the things they did was they assessed their eligibility and they initiated it then. And again, to go from 0% initiation of these drugs to 64% at the time of discharge shows us it can be done.
On that good news note, then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.